from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. High-level talks in Beijing between the United States and China this week have been overwhelmed by the dramatic and continually shifting story of Chen Guangcheng. The blind dissident who escaped to a United States embassy is no longer in U.S. custody, but he remains at the center of a diplomatic brouhaha. And his story is causing tension between the two countries that already struggle to see eye to eye. What's the truth surrounding Chen Guangcheng, and how will his situation affect the bilateral conversations, and what is the current state of U.S.-China relations? Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. U.S.-China strategic and economic talks began today in Beijing, and much is at stake. And as these talks began, a major ongoing crisis looms, centering around the figure of blind legal activist Chen Guangcheng, who escaped from virtual house arrest to the U.S. embassy. And after 6 days spent in the U.S. embassy, his fate now remains uncertain, as well as a central point of ongoing controversy between the United States and China, which could affect the slated talks between the two nations. This forum hour, we want to focus our attention on the recent and ongoing current events bringing U.S. and China together. And joining us is Professor Clayton Duby, who is Executive Director of the U.S.-China Institute, the University of Southern California. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Glad to have you with us. Also glad to have Helen Wong, who is the author of The Chinese Dream, The Rise of the World's Largest Middle Class and What It Means to You. And welcome, Helen Wong.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Jonathan Pollack with us, who is a senior fellow with the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution. And before his appointment at Brookings, he was professor of Asian and Pacific Studies and chair of the Asia-Pacific Studies Group at the Naval War College. And we welcome you, Jonathan Pollack.
Thank you.
We also are trying to connect Orville Schell, who is in Beijing, former head of the UC Berkeley School of Journalism and also a veteran China expert who now directs the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York City. But Professor Clayton Duby, let me begin with you. As I said, a lot is at stake here, very important, but we may be facing a diplomatic crisis. The most recent news is that Chen is seeking asylum in the United States. And how do you see this playing out at this point?
Well, none of us know how it's going to play out. There are many, many different actors, all of them with interests at stake. And so it's impossible to say right now how it will play out. It seemed yesterday that things had worked out perhaps as well as they could have. There were assurances made by the Chinese government to Mr. Chen and to the U.S. government that he would be able to continue his work in China, that he would be able to pursue a formal legal education and be accorded the rights that are due Chinese citizens. But that, of course, all seems to have changed. When he left the embassy, he spoke with a number of friends and with family and now is seeking asylum. And this is not something that the United States can somehow unilaterally grant. We have the power to grant asylum, but we don't have the power to compel the Chinese government to allow Mr. Chen and his family to leave.
There's so much conflict in this drama as it unfolds. I mean, in terms of the different stories that we're hearing about his wanting to leave and not wanting to leave, his family supposedly coming under protection and being assured of security. And yet at this point, it seems like, and I don't know if I'm exaggerating this, but it could derail the whole talks that are going ahead.
Well, everybody that's part of the American delegation, everybody who is welcoming the American delegation, they're working to try to avoid that outcome. They are proceeding on. Other people who are focusing on this particular issue are, for the most part, not the people who are going to be party to these talks. And so those issues that are so important in the U.S.-China relationship, the security issues, the economic issues, environmental concerns, and others, as well as human rights, those will continue to be discussed. As a backdrop, though, in the back of everybody's mind is how the two governments work together to resolve this issue.
And Helen Wong, Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, has essentially told the Chinese that they better do better. I don't want to misphrase what she said or misrepresent, but she said they have to do better in terms of human rights. And the bottom line here is the Chinese don't like to be told, period. What kind of effect do you think that's having?
I think actually what Hillary Clinton said was about right. And he has quoted President Obama says, you know, the country respect rights is good for the country itself. I'm paraphrasing here. And it would be would be stronger for the country who respect rights, human rights will be stronger country and will be stronger partner for the U.S. So that's exactly what China wants. And I think that's actually about right. You say, you know, as a U.S., we always should stand up for our, you know, stand up for our ideal. But on the other hand, we should, you know, let other governments, you know, they believe they have different situation or standards and do a lot of things. Because when I talk to Chinese average people, they do have this impression, oh, U.S. want to using human rights issue to put China down, to stop China from rising. I think that's actually not bad.
Well, there's a great deal of sensitivity on that issue, and it means all the more diplomatic delicacy in terms of respecting China's what they see as their sovereignty.
Yes, yes, it is very delicate. But I support the Obama administration's policy, raise the issue, but not pressing too much. Rather than we should focus the economic and other strategic issues, and which China wants to work with U.S. China does want to cooperate with U.S. As a matter of fact, as the meetings started last night, President Hu Jintao basically said we should break the tradition that big power always have this clash, always have power struggle, rather than we should think new way to work together between U.S. and China.
But Jonathan Pollack, this has become a real political issue here in the United States now, hasn't it?
Well, there's always a latent volatility to this or publicity of this in the United States. But look, I think that the fundamental issues here are now to be sorted out in China, even if it resonates in some political circles in the United States. The reality is quite simple. Whatever ability the United States had to shape the outcome here diminished sharply once Mr. Chun, of his own volition, decided to leave the embassy. What's ironic in this situation is that the agreement that was negotiated with the Chinese in the earlier instance was from our experiences with China remarkably forthcoming. Basically, what Chun was being provided was his original set of desires, that he would still remain in China. He would be able to resume his education, move to a different city, have some assurances about his personal safety. Now, you could argue that's no guarantee in any of this, but the reality of Mr. Chun making a different set of decisions, different calculations now that he is no longer in the embassy has really changed the dynamic here in a major way. So there is an extraordinary delicacy right now to these situations. But I think we need to recognize that the ball now is much more in the court of those in the Chinese system, which admittedly, hopefully, an understanding can still be reached. But the reality is he's not in the embassy anymore, and that has changed the calculation very, very profoundly.
Which means, in effect, that China's back in control. I mean, they had him under virtual house arrest, and he served 4 years in prison for essentially, challenging the Chinese government in terms of abortions and sterilizations under the Chinese ban on more than one child. I mean, do they see him in any ways as sympathetic? Some of what we're reading suggests that because he's blind and because he's disabled and has been a disabled rights activist, that there may even be some sympathy in China?
Well, there may be, but let's bear in mind that we are not talking about a unitary actor in China. It's kind of a mythical creature. You're dealing with a very, very complex bureaucratic process in Beijing with very, very different interests and maybe different perspectives on what should be done with this case, quite apart from the incredible harassment and punishment that was exacted upon him by the local authorities in Shandong, where he came from. So let's understand the complexity of the situation, but obviously Chun seems, by most accounts, a very, very admirable figure. He is clearly under enormous psychological and emotional strain right now. And I think, to be frank, I think he's making a big mistake with respect to talking to too many reporters and too many people. So he has access to telephone, and I understand that he wants to be able to be talking to the outside world. But he's getting a lot of advice, and some of it, frankly, not very good advice, in my judgment.
Well, we want to bring Orville Shulman, this longtime China expert who's written many books on China and who is now director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York City, and longtime friend of the forum program, now in Beijing. Orville, welcome.
Welcome. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. How's this being represented in the Chinese media? I mean, what do you get as a sense of this whole story and the way it's unfolding there?
Well, you know, what's so strange is that at the same time that this story is such a big one abroad and really being vectored out to almost everyone here, there's been almost no mention of it whatsoever. There have been a few official accounts, but they've been all the stranger because most people don't know what the background is. And even the internet has been really cleansed of any reference. So you're like in a parallel universe, in effect.
How do you read the fact that this all began in conjunction with Hillary Clinton's planned trip? I mean, the timing of this.
Well, we still don't know whether this was intentional or not, but it certainly had its point, and it really did sort of tie the American sort of diplomatic community into a knot because they, of course, didn't want to see this whole occasion, which is a big one, blurred. And actually, neither did the Chinese, because they, I think, also take the United States and the relationship with the United States extremely is an extremely important one. And so there was some pressure on both sides, I think, to kind of to conclude a negotiation and get this thing squared away before she arrived. And it looked like they had just made it, and then it began to unravel.
There are conflicting stories, though, as I said earlier, and we continue to try to sort those out. Help us sort out what's up ahead in terms of the talks, assuming they can go ahead and this doesn't provide a serious or formidable obstacle. It seems to be we've got kind of a divide between Secretary Clinton talking about North Korea, Iran, perhaps Sudan, Vietnam, and the Philippines, and Timothy Geithner, Secretary of Treasury, talking about currency and trade policies. Let's look at those sort of from your perspective in terms of what we hope can result or be resolved or anything worked through. More on the foreign issues emphasis, do you think, than on the financial?
Well, you know, I was have been participating in these talks, which are, of course, divided into many different discussions. I mean, this is a hugely sort of complex a biannual meeting where they talk about economics, about policy, about foreign affairs, culture, all of the various exchanges that the two countries have between them. So you sit in the room talking about sort of building better and more constructive relations through, you know, exchanges of Philadelphia Orchestra with whomever. And, of course, no mention is made to this other sort of enormous issue that's looming in the background.
Well, excuse me, Orville. Secretary Clinton, as I said earlier, did say something. It sounded a bit, how shall I put it, light about the importance of human rights and that China needed to respect human rights. But that's just rhetoric at this point, isn't it?
When she did express a sentiment that She didn't believe that human discussions on human rights should trump and sort of cloud out discussions on all the other sort of important issues that the two nations have to deliberate on. And, I mean, this did cause something of a stir, I would have to say. But the point that she was making, is, I think, is an absolutely true one, that, you know, the U.S. and China are two extremely large and important countries, and unless they do have ways to, you know, discuss things with each other in a meaningful and constructive way, whether it's nuclear proliferation, trade, climate change, I mean, you could go on, none of those issues will ever get solved. So I think that was her point. And this, I think this represents the United States making a real effort to show the Chinese that they value this relationship and are willing to go the length to try to make it a constructive one. But alas, that those gestures, I think, have come to naught in the last few days.
Well, that's been the tack of the Obama administration, in fact, to essentially present the United States as not really being in competition to be a top financial dog or whatever you want to call it, where China is concerned. And it seems, again, that the Obama administration is trying to be very careful here and trying not to essentially alienate China. But what do you see as the prospects for making headway toward some of these rather thorny issues that are up ahead?
Well, you know, I think this is true, and this is the new reality, that China is incredibly important. This relationship is incredibly important, and that we have to have a way to talk with them, or we simply are going to be outdone by some very important issues. So, I mean, having said that, I think that's why what has just happened is been in many ways so devastating, was that despite those efforts and gestures, we seem still to have come a cropper. And, you know, it's very difficult to know what more the United States can do except sort of arching its back.
Is the back arched at this point?
Well, we don't quite know yet. I mean, I think by the end of this discussion, which will be tomorrow, then statements will be made and press conferences will be held, and there's going to have to be some hard reckoning on the American side, the Chinese side too. But I should also say that, you know, the Chinese are I think one has the impression they are quite divided. There are many people here who also think that the relationship between the U.S. and China is incredibly important, and that China has to be very sensitive in how it treats it. There are others who are much more reckless and who are willing to see the whole thing blow up and willing to push it to the limit. So we can't see that very clearly from afar. We can't even see it very clearly from up close. But this society, like any, has its divisions and its disagreements, and there are different forces sort of responding and to what happens and acting things out.
How much does China feel, well, it has a stake in this in terms of the American economy? And by that I mean American economy was looked at by China, especially all the debt that the United States has incurred, was looked at by China as really being well, what they were hitching their stars to, so to speak. And at this point, things seem to be reversing and moving in China's direction. That gives them leverage, doesn't it?
Well, they have a certain amount of leverage on the debt issue. On the other hand, you know, they bought an enormous amount of treasury bills and other kinds of securities in America, and that's financed our debt. But they have to be extremely careful that they don't jeopardize the very debt they've bought. And they also have a very limited number of options as to where to put their money. And it does pile up because of the way in which the nature of the trade relationship. So they don't have as many options as one might think, just because we owe a debt to them. In a funny way, we're bound at the hip, And it makes the point that I made earlier that in actuality, our destinies are linked, and we simply have to have ways to talk to each other, because if we don't, both sides will end up being hurt.
It's a kind of mutual assured destruction almost, isn't it? Financially.
We have, without quite realizing it, and the same goes for the Chinese, we have become joined together. And that's why the reality is that our interests are a lot more attached than we sometimes imagine when we think we might just sort of walk out the door and forget them for a while.
We're talking with Orville Schell, who's with us from Beijing, director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York City. Orville, how do you see the Bo Zilai controversy playing into this, the Politburo member, the scandal involving him in terms of power play?
Well, when his police chief, Wang Lijin, tried to make a dash for the American consulate in Chengdu, and the whole scandal of this mayor of Chongqing, which, by the way, is the largest city in the world, some 32 million people, when all of that happened, that was the first sort of dot on the graph of A, and the Chinese to run off to an American diplomatic mission, but B, a kind of a hint behind the veil of how things are done. This is not a tremendously transparent society. And so then when this other incident happened with Chen Guangcheng, the sort of self-trained dissident lawyer, here was the second dot. And you began to get a trend of people sort of using American diplomatic missions for refuge in their own purposes. And God knows where this is going to go from here. It could get quite strange if people all over China, for whatever reason, start seeking sort of redress of grievances in consulates and embassies.
Well, Chen Guangcheng suggested that perhaps he might want to fly back, according to some reports, with Secretary Clinton on her plane, and was talking about the fact that he could not be assured of his family getting protection in Shandong province. In fact, there were threats on his life, supposedly, that the State Department said that they were not aware of, and they said that he had voluntarily said that he would stay in China. I mean, the reports are so conflicting that it's very difficult to sort them out.
Well, it's true. I didn't hear the very first part of the conversation, but I did hear Jonathan Pollack suggesting that, Chen Guangcheng might have had second thoughts when he got out. And I think that's very true. I think the American diplomats who actually worked long and hard to negotiate this thing and did the best they could, were quite surprised. And it probably doesn't serve him well at this point to make it sound as if he was expelled unfairly from the embassy. He decided to leave, but I think with tremendous reticence, as we understand, because his wife and kids were outside. But once having gotten outside, he realized that he was all by himself, and then started having some regret and some doubts, and was counseled by his lawyer that maybe that was the wrong decision. But, of course, there was no and is no going back.
Orville Schell with us from Beijing, again, the director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. And, Orville, good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
And you can join us. In fact, let me invite you to do that. We're going to continue with Professor Clayton Duby and with Helen Wong and Jonathan Pollack and get more analysis from them, and also get your calls and emails. You can call us now if you have something you'd like to add to this conversation, or if you have questions or comments. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Please join the program if you're inclined to do so, 866-733-6786. You can also let us know what you think or send questions to us via email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also communicate with us by going to our Facebook page. We'll continue with Professor Clayton Duby of the U.S.-China Institute, and with Helen Wong, author of The Chinese Dream, and with Jonathan Pollack, senior fellow with the John L. Thornton China Center at Brookings. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. High-level talks in Beijing between the United States and China have begun and have been really overwhelmed by the dramatic and continually shifting story of Chen Guangcheng, a blind political activist who is at the center of a diplomatic he said, she said, and whose story is causing a great deal of tension between the two countries already struggling to see eye to eye. We spoke earlier with Orville Schell, who is director of the Center of U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. And we have with us Professor Clayton Duby and Helen Wong and Jonathan Pollack. And we're going to go to your calls in short order here. I want to go first to our guests. And Jonathan Pollack, this is turning into quite a bit of a political circus here. Do you agree with Orville Schell that we're too joined at the hip to let these talks fall into shambles?
Well, in one respect, I do agree with Orville, but that's the bigger picture of U.S.-China relations, not the particulars of this given case, which necessarily has the quality of a, if you will, a diplomatic crisis. The intent here at the point where Chun was at the embassy was, of course, to try to find some way to reach an agreement between the U.S. and China to manage this so that it would not intrude on the issues under consideration at the Strategic and Economic Dialogue. And that would be fine as long as the deal held. But the deal didn't hold because Chun had second thoughts. And again, as I said before, I can understand the pressure this man is under, the emotional strain. All of a sudden, he found himself, as Orville noted, alone at the hospital. Under those circumstances, hearing from a lot of activist circles in the Chinese human rights community, hearing from his lawyer and so forth, they all urged him to leave China, which was different than the deal that had been negotiated between American and Chinese officials. So, in effect, we've entered uncharted territory. It's no longer a case, at least at the moment, of negotiations between the United States and China on this, although perhaps they will resume once the Strategic and Economic Dialogue is concluded. But the United States has not had any direct access to Mr. Chun, private access to Mr. Chun, since he entered the hospital on Wednesday. No doubt U.S. officials will try to do so. But again, whatever leverage was there dissipated very, very sharply. I think it's also very important to note that this entire case touches a lot of very, very hot-button issues in China. Remember, of course, an embassy is U.S. sovereign territory, but we have no claim, no recourse once Chun, as a Chinese citizen, is back on Chinese soil, other than hopefully some kind of a shared interest in seeing that this does not get blown out of proportion and does not unravel other kinds of critically important issues between the United States and China. That's where we are right now. To be frank, I don't think it's really a case of that much of conflicting viewpoints of he said, she said. I think it's quite clear that Mr. Chun came to different judgments after he left the embassy. And that's where we find ourselves right now.
And it's a place, Professor Clayton Duby, which really presents very many vexing questions. I mean, just in terms of how to proceed. I mean, at this point, the United States has to be very tentative and realize that these somewhat fragile ongoing discussions about the fate of Mr. Cheng are quite serious.
In a very delicate way from the very outset. Even when Chun was at the embassy, there was no formal acknowledgement that he was at the embassy. And this was the case more than 20 years ago when Fang Lijie was a resident at the U.S. embassy as well. Everybody knew this to be the case, but it was not formally acknowledged, because formal acknowledgement would be tweaking the Chinese government, would be seen as a confrontational statement. And so everybody tried to work this particular problem, to talk with Mr. Chun to find out what he wanted. And then efforts were made to work out an arrangement whereby the Chinese would offer some guarantees that he would be accorded those things. And this was a long process. It's important to understand that if the shoe were on the other foot, if an American, and the way that this is understood within China, within the Chinese government, this is somebody who had been convicted of a crime and had spent time in jail, who in some ways was seen as a troublemaker. If an American went to the Chinese embassy and went in there and was then the United States government would not want to negotiate with the Chinese government over what to do on this. We would deny that that was the way that we would proceed in terms of how you would handle the case of an individual.
But forgive me, there were Americans who defected to China.
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. And in fact, after the Korean War, there were a number who chose to remain in China. And that's certainly, that happens. That's not the point. The point is to understand how the Chinese understand this, and it's not to draw a moral equivalence. Mr. Chen was somebody who has only asserted the rights that the Chinese Constitution says he has. He has sought to defend the rights of individuals, marginalized people in rural China. He has sought to stand up for them. And in 2005, he came to world attention for this. In 2006, he was formally incarcerated. He served more than 4 years. And now he's been technically free, but without any of the freedom that we usually associate with that term. And so it's not really a surprise to me that now that he has access to media, now that he is surrounded and it would be difficult for the Chinese government to close off access to him, that he is talking to everybody he can. Now, that may not be in his best interest, and I think that it's probably the case that he's received some bad advice, and he is under enormous strain. But what the United States can do in this situation is seriously limited. All that can be done now is to focus attention on the issues that he has raised, the treatment he has received, and to argue, as he has, that he is due rights as a Chinese citizen that the Chinese Constitution says he has.
And before I go to your calls, I want to go once more to Helen Wong, who, again, is the author of the book The Chinese Dream, The Rise of the World's Largest Middle Class and What It Means to You. There is certainly probably not necessarily power in the middle class in China, in a ruling hegemonic world of China, but it's a rising middle class, and it's rising in its power. How do you feel, just intuitively, they are regarding this whole scandal, diplomatic mess, or whatever we want to call it, Helen Wong?
I think Mr. Chen, Chen Guangchen, is a little bit different from Bo Xilai, which a scandal. And Chen Guangchen does provide inspiration for average Chinese, and because he has gone very far as a blind person, and you know, he's fighting a very difficult battle, and now, when the system failed him, he sought protection from U.S. You know, that's good news for us, because you know, so that means U.S. still represent a certain kind of justice and some fairness among Chinese people, which is good. A lot of people I talk to, they do. You know, they admire American democracy and freedom, but on the other hand, they understand the situation in China is different, and they don't even hold China the same standard as the U.S. And I do think Chen Guangchen made a huge mistake by leaving the embassy. Now, as the other analysts have talked about, there's very little U.S. can do. We can do it right now. Maybe after this talk finished, I don't know what else we can do diplomatically.
Well, we'll obviously continue to follow the story, and a lot more may unfold today, as Orville Schell suggested earlier. But let me bring our callers in. And Ray, thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I'm truly amazing to be on a call with these participants. I actually have known Orville Schell a very long time. I just want to preface my comments with some of my background. I lived and worked and studied in Beijing for 5 years. I managed money for the National Endowment for Democracy. I've funded underground dissidents and writers, and I can't believe that I've come to ground these opinions. But I support what Obama and the administration is doing by saying, look, freedom and the opportunity to express yourself as you wish, and of being empowered to live the lives that you want, and having a justice system to protect those rights is important. But we do, and I agree, need to stop telling China what to do. And we need to really stop, coddling the dissident du jour. I think a lot of the panelists participating today will agree that I think we spend a disproportionate amount of time supporting the dissident du jour, but often are distracted by the bigger issues, like Tibet. You know, the students that burned themselves, the other week for Tibetan rights, and the Dalai Lama. And I just find that incredulous that we ignore the bigger macro human rights issues with China. But I just want to reiterate, I think the administration's approach, not telling China what to do, not inflaming them, and yet, keeping to our business and defending our rights and our way of system when we need to and when it's right. But I think we spend way too much time in Guangcheng and Feng Lizhi and the endless number of names that have come through our embassy over the years.
Well, I thank you for those sentiments. And Jonathan Pollack, let's get some reaction to you from that. Our dissident du jour helping to overshadow really not only the talks but maybe America's best interests, and we just have to kind of keep in the shadows and not try to dictate to China?
Well, I think among other things, your caller made some very, very apt comments. When we made progress is when this was being kept quiet. Quiet diplomacy, quiet negotiations, as, of course, Mr. Chun weighed his options when he was there and the security, safety of the U.S. Embassy, even though he's obviously not an American citizen. What's happened now is that everyone has gotten into the act, from members of Congress to the Chinese dissident community to activists of one persuasion or another, and it leads to this muddled, if not confused, at least hyper-activated situation, which makes concession coming from a very prickly government in Beijing that much more difficult and really misses a lot of the bigger picture. So in a way, this is what happens. Orville's point that there's very little that we can see in Chinese media right now about this or even in the Chinese blogosphere. And yet, this has consumed us on this side of the pond and, of course, is generating a lot of expectations and pressures on the American officials who are responsible for trying to deal with this in a quiet way. Quiet doesn't come to mind anymore on this. And, it may well be that for some of the people who feel these issues so passionately, the degree to which they can get publicity and the like is what they are seeking. But I don't know that it really helps Mr. Chun in the very, very difficult circumstances and decisions that presumably he's going to face. And it certainly doesn't make it easy for us to deal with those parts of the Chinese political system that we are trying to negotiate with credibly. We also don't want to, in effect, by default almost, empower some of the more repressive parts of the Chinese system. And yet that's exactly what will happen here in all too predictable fashion as a consequence of how this has played out.
It's been the pattern all along, pretty much, as you're suggesting. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Pollack, again, senior fellow with the John L. Thornton China Center and former chair of the Asia-Pacific Studies Group at the Naval War College. And we go to Henry as our next caller. Welcome. You're on.
Hi, I'm Henry. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Henry.
As a Chinese living in the States for more than one decade, I think it's in the Chinese government's best interest to let him to come to the States. Actually, the Chinese government should like every so-called dissident to come to the States if they want. Because I have been following those so-called dissidents for a long time. For most of the time, they don't even know what they're talking about. So they cannot make any positive contribution to the Chinese society in any way. So if they want to waste the United States taxpayers' dollars, that's fine. But please do not waste the Chinese taxpayers' dollar anymore, period.
All right. I thank you, Henry, for the call. Helen Wong, it seems unlikely, though, that the Chinese government would go into the United States and let them open their arms and embrace you and welcome you.
Well, I think at this time it's kind of unlikely Chinese government would let Mr. Chen go. And on one hand, they sort of lose the face. On the other hand, I don't think that's a likely situation. It's really hard to see how this will be resolved. Except I have to say, Mr. Chen had illusion that the Chinese central government would really, do what they promised, it will really protect him. But once he gets out, they realize the reality that's not going to be the case. And that should be predictable for anybody, particularly for his situation. He has been in China. For me, I even knew, all these supporters, went through all this trouble to get him out in the embassy. But anyway, I seem unlikely the Chinese government would let him go outside the country.
Yeah, well, I thank the caller, and remind listeners, by the way, if you want to join us, it's 866-733-6786. Your calls are welcome at that toll-free number, 866-733-6786. If you have something you'd like to contribute, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. And Professor Clayton Duby, listener Scott writes on our web page, at what level is the abuse of Chen Guangcheng likely to be sanctioned? Does it end with just the local level? Is there likely a higher level of government involved, or perhaps the levels of government above the local level just turned a blind eye? No pun intended.
Yes. Well, first, to make a comment about Henry's comment, I think actually at one point it might have been possible for Mr. Chen to come to the United States to have worked out some sort of arrangement where he might receive medical treatment in the United States and his family might be able to accompany him. That has happened in the past for specific dissidents. And again, Mr. Chen is not a dissident in the sense he wants to overthrow the Chinese government. He's trying to hold the Chinese government to account for its own rules and the actions of government officials. And so he's in a slightly different category, and I think that's one of the reasons why those Chinese who do know him admire him. But the point I think that Jonathan was making was a very important one, and also Ray, the previous caller. With Mr. Chen, there's a human face to the human rights issue. And that always, I think, resonates with Americans. There have been more than two dozen Tibetans who have set themselves aflame. And yet we don't know most of those people. We haven't been able to visualize them. And so that's part of why this has so captured the imagination. Also, of course, there are various human rights groups, Christian groups, and politicians who have emphasized this particular incident. But there are a lot of issues at play between the United States and China. And I think everybody here, Jonathan, Helen, Orville, everybody has emphasized that we are joined on the hip and that, for example, our trade relationship, market access, these things also have a human rights component because they speak to labor rights, they speak to a lot of different other issues, environmental protection. In China, this is a huge human rights issue. And so I think we need to have a broader understanding of the ways in which we are connected between the United States and China and the importance of those connections and seek to put this in proper perspective.
Let me bring another caller on. John, welcome. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. Hey, I just wanted to say that this just seems like this is Chinese doing a bait and switch. Why would they have promised him, as was reported to us, freedom once he left the embassy? They were going to send him to college and let him get a formal degree, give him access to the media or some sort of freedom. That once they got him out of the embassy, then they told him what was really going to happen, which was they were going to beat him or beat his wife or he'd end up somewhere else. And the United States was somewhat complicit because they wanted to get this trade deal going, and they didn't want to have this guy sitting in their embassy. So, he may just be a speed bump in this whole process, or he may be someone that, you know, later on we look back and see as one of the people that started the opening of China. But most likely, you know, if you look at past history in Tiananmen Square, we thought something was going to happen there. And China is going to continue going in the path that serves China.
Well, John, I thank you for that call. And sort of in counterpoint to John's call, I'm looking at an email from a listener named Mark who writes, Michael, it seems you're letting the U.S. version of the story go unchallenged. According to AP, instead of having an inexplicable change of heart, Chun says that he was pressured into accepting the deal by U.S. officials and the Chinese government was threatening to send his family back to the thugs that have been abusing them. Seems the U.S. diplomats were desperately trying to make this embarrassment go away in advance of the talks. And I suppose to some extent, Professor Duby, that is, again, an indication of just how much these stories are running against one another.
Well, I was not party to the talks, and so I can't speak to them specifically. I can say, I can repeat what the American side has said, which is that, you know, they spent a lot of time and had Chun's assurances that this was what he wanted, that he wanted to be reunited with his family, that he wanted to remain in China, that he wanted to increase his capacity to represent the interests of Chinese people. And the American diplomats need to take him at his word. At the same time, he probably had limited access to information. And we need to understand that when he got out, other people said, why are you going to stay? You won't be protected. His family repeated how told him how they had been treated in the time after his escape. Before they were reunited. Those sorts of things, of course, did impact him.
And you are listening to Forum. We're talking with Professor Clayton Duby, also with Helen Wong and Jonathan Pollack. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we're going to go to another caller here. And Frank, that's you. Join us, Frank. Hi.
Hi. So what if he never intended to leave China? What if he knows this is going to be very problematic? What if he never even intended to live for very long? What if he just wanted to draw attention to himself? I mean, just as your callers have mentioned, there are many examples like him. I mean, Liu Xiaobo won a Nobel Prize, and what happened to him? I mean, when you're behind the Iron Curtain, even very powerful powers, let's say, in the world, cannot do much about you. The other thing is, there's mention in the report about the Chinese government demanding an apology from the U.S. And so would the panelists comment on how likely that threat is going to play out? Thank you.
Well, thank you for those remarks. Helen Wong, we're kind of in the world of speculation again here, though, clearly.
Well, it's hard to think, you know, what Mr. Chun have gone through. It's hard to think he's trying to draw attention to himself, etc. But I do think before he stated clearly he wanted to stay in China, which is very understandable. Any Chinese, the first thing they always want to hold is they love their own country. They don't want to leave their own country, go to another country, unless it's absolutely, you know, necessary. Then I understand that part, and he wants to live in China. But I also think he did have an illusion that central government, the Wen Jiabao, will do something to punish those local thugs to protect him. And that's why I think he misjudged that he made a mistake to leave embassy. So that's the situation. That's what I believe. It's hard to think. He already has enough attention since 2005, and I don't think he needs more attention. But at this point, he may under a tremendous psychological pressure, and he's a little bit desperate.
Well, let me go back to you, Jonathan Pollack, looking at a listener named Joe who writes, honestly, what did Cheng Wancheng think was going to happen? He dramatically escapes house arrest to seek refuge in the U.S. embassy, but then doesn't want to leave China and wants a new life in China. Did he honestly think the Chinese government was just going to forget this whole thing happened? Of course he and his family are going to be threatened. I don't know anything much about China, but common sense would suggest this.
Joe's comments are very apt. Of course, it's very difficult for any of us to put ourselves in Mr. Chun's shoes and what he may be thinking. As best we can tell, as we've tried to reconstruct his initial thinking when he sought to escape from his it wasn't formal imprisonment, but it was isolation and quasi-incarceration. It's not clear that he and his fellow dissidents who were advising him then really had a plan in mind. But he really wanted to get out. And then the path ultimately led him to deal with officials at the U.S. Embassy because it seemed to be the best course of action that he had. But even then, I'm not quite sure that he knew what his expectations were. That's why, again, going back to what one of the other listeners queried you about, you know, was China engaged in some kind of bait and switch? Well, you know, at one level, we will really never know. What we can know, however, is that senior U.S. diplomats in Beijing, including the Assistant Secretary of State, Kurt Campbell, were able to negotiate an agreement with Chinese counterparts that on paper at least, or not on paper, it was verbal, would have taken actions on the part of the Chinese authorities that they've never been prepared to take before. Now, we can be cynical about it and say that this was never going to materialize. We don't know. Maybe both sides were just trying to find a way just to get beyond the immediate crisis so that we could proceed with the scheduled talks in Beijing. But it was a window, and that window, I fear, has now closed yet again. I don't know what Mr. Chun's fate will be. I don't know what the calculations of the Chinese government may be, but it just highlights the extraordinary stakes that we face in this very, very complex relationship with China, which is never going to have us or them wholly satisfied with the way things are.
Well, we'll let it stay there. And I want to extend thanks to all of our guests, Orville Schell, who was with us for the first part of the program, director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society, and Jonathan Pollack, senior fellow with the John L. Thornton China Center at the Brookings Institution, and Helen Wong, who is the author of The Chinese Dream, The Rise of the World's Largest Middle Class and What It Means to You, and Professor Clayton Duby, who is executive director of the U.S.-China Institute, University of Southern California. Thanks to you, our listeners, and thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell and Christina Russo. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, who believe all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.